This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Before we go any further or even talk about the show or anything, just a massive respect and love to Jeff for an excellent edition of On The Record. It's always such a brilliant way to start your Monday week with all those stories and news items. You can always tune in to On The Record every weekday here on RTRFM from 9 in the AM. But this is the Indie Media Show. It's all the news and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. It's all about citizen journalism, activist media, that kind of thing. Today's program, we've got quite a few stories for you. We're going to be chatting to two people, Sarah and Lily from The Abortion Project. You might have seen, if you're paying attention, there was a so-called pro-life rally outside Parliament last Wednesday, and a group of very brave pro-choice activists went down there to counter the demonstration and, you know, talk about, you know, the abortion is both a medical and a human right. So we're going to be chatting to both Sarah and Lily a little bit later in the show to find out all about the Abortion Project and about what happened outside of Parliament last Wednesday. We're also going to be catching up with Janie Lowe, who is going to be talking to us a bit about native title and some of the issues around native title groups and holders and some of the complications around that. And we're also going to be chatting about the School of Critical Arts. Carl came in to talk to us just only moments ago, and we're going to be talking all about School of Critical Arts and some of the alternative courses they've got coming up this year. They're a sort of open university style project, a school that offer about 10 courses, so really interesting stuff. Lots of reasons to keep it locked to Indie Media this morning. Now, on the weekend, hundreds of thousands of people took part in protests across the US on Saturday to decry the Supreme Court's expected reversal of the landmark 1973 law that made abortion legal in America. It's a huge thing. It's potentially going to make as expected, the Supreme Court does reverse the 1973 law, it's going to make abortion illegal in many states in the United States. However, it's not just in the US in which there are people still refusing to accept people's choice and their ability to make a choice around their own body. Here in Perth on Wednesday, a group of so-called pro-life activists gathered outside Parliament to have their views heard. But a group decided to go down there and counter them. About 12 or 15 or so people, pro-choice activists, went down there and let them know that there is, you know, an alternative. There are people that see this differently. A couple of those people are Sarah and Lily from the Abortion Project. And a little earlier today, I had the opportunity to speak to them. And I started just by asking them what happened at Parliament on Wednesday night.
So we both run a project called the Abortion Project. It's a peer support group for people in the Fremantle area who have lived experience with abortion. We've been doing that since October, and we run sessions that we talk about our experiences with abortion, our support groups, our experiences with medical providers. And last week we had a session on the Roe and Wade case. And when we were preparing for that session, we were looking up protests within Perth, and we found this anti-abortion protest that we weren't really aware of. So it was pretty spontaneous, and we just had a couple of days, and then we rallied some troops from the Abortion Project and some allies, and we decided to counter-protest. We didn't really have any idea about what it was going to be like. We rocked up, and there were so many more people than we expected, probably approximately around 1,000 people. And there was people speaking on stage. It was run by the Coalition for Human Rights. Human Life. which is a group of Christian lobby groups. So we just decided to get up on stage. We didn't have a plan to get up on stage, but there were only around 12 to 15 of us, and we wanted to make the disrupt their protest and make the biggest impact as possible. And so, yeah, we got up on stage. We started chanting and holding our signs, and it immediately got pretty violent. Our signs were ripped off us. Yeah, we were pushed and shoved, and but we ended up staying there up on stage for around 15 minutes, which is awesome, and we were able to disrupt their anti-abortion rhetoric. And yeah, then we got moved on off stage, and we continued to stay there. We continued to chant. They had a minute of silence, and everybody held up four items of baby clothing. So during that minute of silence, we were protesting that and making sure that people knew that abortion is a issue for people who have had abortions, and it's a medical issue, and it's our body, our rights.
Now, that must have been quite intense. Lily, you were also there. I mean, were you surprised that there were over 1,000 people in Perth attending a so-called pro-life rally? I mean, I guess it's something that a lot of our listeners probably, you know, they're obviously aware of, but we often think of, you know, pro-life as being, you know, more common in, say, the United States or something. Was it quite shocking to see so many people with these views out in Perth?
Yes and no, really. We know that they've been holding this rally since abortion was decriminalised in Western Australia in 1998. So this is their 24th year. And, yeah, we know that last year there were 850 people who attended. So we kind of suspected that it would be a little bit busier considering what's happening in the US at the moment, and the fact that as well that there's a federal election this weekend, but still very taken aback by just how many people were there, and taken aback by their immediate response to it, which was of anger towards us. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the United States there, and this weekend there were more than 300 pro-choice protests in the US against the expected reversal of the 1973 landmark law that made abortion legal. How significant is this expected Supreme Court decision in the States to reverse this law, and what kind of impacts do you think it could have for women in the US?
Yeah, so I guess firstly we'd like to acknowledge that it's not just women who have abortions. I think that, you know, heteronormativity is everywhere, and abortion is not immune to that. So, yeah, that it's women and people with uteruses who access abortion. But really this is an extremely significant turn of events. It will, in effect, ban abortion in what is expected to be half of the states. So it'll mean that anyone who participates in any kind of abortion service or access will be criminalised, and it will just further silence abortion, which is already a major issue. I guess it's not incredibly silent in the US. It's very it's a huge political issue there, but it will silence people from being able to speak about their experiences and to provide those services. So, yeah, it's catastrophic, I think.
And something that we talk a lot about at the Abortion Project is within Australia how silent abortion is. And I think that I can't even imagine being in a place where abortion is illegal and you have to go to a different state to get that, and not being able to talk to your support network or people around you about the fact that you are travelling interstate to get an abortion because that's illegal.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, because I guess it's not just, you know, as you say, that it's the access to the medical services, but it's the entire culture that is affected, and the fact that you're not even allowed to discuss it. I mean, obviously it's a different circumstance here in Australia, and while there are thousands of pro-lifers out in the streets demonstrating it at least once a year here in Perth, at least, you know, it's not illegal to have an abortion in Western Australia or Australia. But do you think that this reversal of this Supreme Court decision that's expected in the US, do you think it will potentially have a sort of, if not a legislative impact, at least a cultural impact here in Australia, and make it harder for people who are seeking abortions?
Like you said, I guess the politics and law in Australia are different to the US, but it's also important to note that symbolically and ideologically, the US has a really large influence on Australia. And although we have relatively secure laws, abortion is still stigmatised and silenced in Australia, and it's not really seen as routine healthcare. So I guess the reversal of Roe and Wade and how that could influence Australia would be a potential to add fuel to the fire for anti-abortion activists. But also, we think it's a really great time that abortion is now within the Australian public discourse. And yet, it's a really great time to be talking about the issues in Australia that we already have, mainly relating to access and destigmatisation and silencing. And yeah, I think Lily can talk a little bit on that.
Yeah, so we have a lot of access issues and barriers that exist here already, and one of the significant ones is that it's a postcode lottery. So depending on where you live, your proximity to clinics will have a major impact on your ability to access an abortion, not to mention the cost, which it depends on your circumstances, but you know, you have to have two appointments with the doctor. If you're getting a medical abortion, that's a cost, and then not to mention the recovery. There's also, in effect, the privatisation of abortion. So that's the result of GPs needing to be certified to prescribe medical abortion, and surgeons needing to be trained, especially for that surgery, which we just think should be a part of your basic medical training, considering the prevalence of abortion. In terms of legislation, when we're not sure what will happen, but it's a great opportunity to talk about these issues and to raise awareness around these issues.
We're speaking to Sarah and Lily from the Abortion Project. As we previously discussed, a group of you, pro-choice activists, bravely countered the so-called pro-life demonstration last Wednesday in Perth. Now, given the history of the so-called pro-life activists picketing abortion centres, attacking doctors and women and others, it's not really an exaggeration to say that some of these people can be very dangerous. So I guess with that in mind, how important is it to counter these pro-life demonstrations, especially given that many of them would now be feeling emboldened by the events in the US?
Yeah, so I think, first and foremost, it is dangerous, and we learned that. We experienced that firsthand on Wednesday night, and I think, it is dangerous to engage in activism across the board. For me, it was really important to show up and say what I believed in. And it was also important for me when we got there were so many kids, and I just really wanted them to see that there are other ways of thinking about abortion, that it's a right. It's healthcare. It's not a religious issue. And how about you, Sarah?
I think it was really important for me to counter protest their protests, and although we were met with violence, I looked around at the 15 of us and how much impact we had on their rally, which there were so many more of them, and even us, just a small group of people, were able to be so disruptive and show our opinion within that space, which was really amazing.
But I think as well, you know, that it's a balancing act, and what we're seeing in the US at the moment didn't just happen overnight. You know, it's not as though a Supreme Court judge just woke up and decided to overrule or to start overruling Roe v. Wade. It's the result of a long, sustained chipping away of abortion via abortion access via legislation. So while it's important to show up to these demonstrations and to protest, it's also important to be aware of any changes that are happening to the laws, both here in Australia and elsewhere.
Certainly, and as you've mentioned there, the Abortion Project do a whole range of things, and you know, not just countering these demonstrations. If our listeners are keen on supporting the work that you do, what's the best way they can get involved and take part, and whether that's expressing solidarity or whether they have had experiences with abortion themselves, what's the best way they can get involved?
Yeah, so primarily we're a peer support group, So we have an Instagram. Everything's happened quite quickly for us. But if you want to get involved or lend your support, find us on Instagram. It's the.abortionproject. We have a newsletter that you can sign up for, or if you have lived experience with abortion, you can fill out our registration form and come along to one of our meetings. We're going to have a fundraiser in June, so we'll announce that through Instagram and our newsletter. And we're also presenting at the Children by Choice conference in Brisbane in August. So we're really excited to get together with the abortion industry and talk about peer support and strategies for what's to come.
We also, I think another way that you can support us is by, and in general, is by normalising abortion. Start a conversation in your community, with your friends, with your family, because it's routine healthcare, and it's something that an estimated 1 in 4 to 1 in 6 women and pregnant people will have an abortion in their lifetime in Australia. So it's incredibly prevalent here, and we just really want that to be normalised.
That was Lily and Sarah from the Abortion Project speaking to us earlier today. And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. Native title is something that is sometimes quite complex and complicated, and I guess there's many in both the Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities that have been calling for reforms and changes to the Native Title Law for a long time. Kelly from Indie Media, Kelly Warden, had the opportunity to catch up with National Native Title Council CEO Jamie Lowe to chat about the work he's doing to reform legislation to help protect traditional owners' rights to care for country and decide on how it's used.
When Rio Tinto blew up Juukan Gorge 2 years ago, it sparked an international focus on the West Australian mining industry for all the worst reasons. Going against the wishes of traditional owners, Rio Tinto had destroyed a 46,000-year-old rock shelter on the hunt for higher-grade iron ore. When news broke out that Rio Tinto had blown up Juukan Gorge, people around Australia and the world all started asking how something so tragic could occur. For those who didn't already know the answer to this question, a federal inquiry showed that the laws governing mining activity in Western Australia were outdated and unfit for purpose, that there were entrenched inequalities and weaknesses in things like the Native Title Act, which meant First Nations people actually had very little power to say no to companies wanting to mine their land. Ever since the Juukan Gorge disaster, pressure has been mounting on the government and mining industry leaders to make systemic and structural changes that will ensure something like this never happens again. Recently, the National Aboriginal Press Club held its fifth event at Optus Stadium, where some of these leaders came to speak about the future of WA's mining and energy sector and its relationship with First Nations communities. One of the speakers was Native Title Council CEO Mr. Jamie Lowe, who addressed several key issues about the mining sector's activity in WA. Mr. Lowe is a proud Gunditjmara and Jabiru man who grew up in Ballarat, Victoria. Internationally, Jamie is a representative on the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. We caught up with Mr. Lowe in the studio last week to delve a little bit deeper into the work he's been doing with the Native Title Council to raise the bar for traditional owners when it comes to their rights to decide what happens on their land. In our interview, Mr. Lowe highlighted the need for better social reinvestment into Aboriginal communities, and we spoke about the role and opportunities for First Nations communities to either benefit or once again be exploited by renewable energy leaders in a carbon-neutral economy. All very good reasons to keep it locked to indie media on RTRFM.
Since the colonisers came along, you know, they've been mining this country since pretty much day one. And mining's going to continue into the future, so we have to be a bit real about that. So we just need to make sure the relationship's balanced. And we don't feel like it is at the moment, and that's due to kind of poor legislation. I know the state government here are pretty bullish about it. They think it's the kind of the best stand and it's the high bar. But with our investigation and research, it's not. There's still got a bit of a way to go. I think there's a pretty strong view from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people out there that the Native Title Act doesn't go far enough in protecting rights and interests for Native title holders. Mm-hmm. You're forced into this agreement process because if you sit it out and say no, they just apply through the Native Title Tribunal and, you know, they get a right to access land anyway, or 90%. 97% of cases so far that's happened. So, you know, we're trying to uphold the principle of free, prior, and informed consent, and the Native Title Act doesn't do that at the moment. We're doing a lot of work with the federal government, you know, potentially modernising national legislation, which may be able to set a bar and a standard across the nation with some consistency. So rather than having the kind of the bad and not so good, we can get it to a bar that's good. And then, you know, if states want to exceed that, you know, well, that's good on them.
What would that kind of national legislation look like?
Well, at the moment we are doing a true co-design process where we're sitting around with the Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment. We've got direct lines to the minister in charge of both the Environmental Act and Aboriginal Heritage Act that sits in the Commonwealth level. So we're not trying to predetermine what that looks like, but we do hope that it sets a higher bar. And what that looks like, we're not sure. We're just early days of actually going out there and talking to the community. Mm-hmm. So it's an informed process where we're talking to the community about what, you know, some of the issues that we think, but also some of the issues that they think as well. So we're at stage one at the moment, and then hopefully we can start drawing up kind of maybe draft legislation to hopefully get it across the table. But I guess the tricky thing with that is that you kind of need all the states and territories to agree to get it across the line, because, you know, heritage kind of sits within their remit. So it's going to be tough, but, you know, we think we can have a crack and get it done.
Mr. Lowe also called out the WA state government for not allocating enough money towards social reinvestment for Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal-controlled services. The WA economy grew by 4.3% in the 2020-2021 financial year, the strongest of all states for the second year in a row, placing WA as one of the top-performing economies in the world, second only to China. Despite amassing this wealth, which has largely been due to the mining sector, Mr. Lowe says the government hasn't used the opportunity to reinvest in communities.
I think there's a massive opportunity for the state of WA to really invest in the community, not only the Aboriginal community, but more broadly as well. They've got the fastest growing economy in the world, apart from China. Mm. It's a big deal. It's a point of pride for the state, which it probably should be. But, you know, what are you doing with it? There needs to be a legacy, a positive legacy left within the community. You know, they can't be here in 10 years' time saying, oh, we need to do better still. And particularly growing up in Ballarat, you know, in a kind of, you know, sub-adequate, sub-standard kind of housing, all that kind of stuff. But then you look around, there's old money. And so it's just kind of stark. And then, you know, it doesn't take much here in WA. You drive around, whether it be Kalgoorlie or other communities, even here in Perth, you see the difference. And so there needs to be, you know, a considered way of investing in
the First Nations community here, so, you know, you're not having the similar conversation in 10 or 15 years' time.
And what do you think needs to change sort of explicitly about the government's approach?
I guess the governments need to have a long-term view, yeah, not a view of kind of a cycle of government. So if they look at, you know, what they want WA to look like as a state in, 10 years' time and what type of investment needs to take place to get them there. It sounds simple, and I guess it is simple when you've got the money to do it.
The McGowan government recently committed $14.6 million for the Department of Mines, Industry Regulation and Safety to establish an Aboriginal Empowerment Unit and implement its Aboriginal Empowerment Initiative program. The government says this program will ensure mining projects and policies are developed in a culturally respectful way and improve information access for Aboriginal people related to activities on their lands. Mr. Lowe says this funding is welcomed, but that it is out of balance with the funding given to the establishment of local Aboriginal cultural heritage services, which he abbreviates to LARCS. Setting up the LARCS is the final step in progressing the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill and will be the go-to groups to help negotiate and facilitate agreement making on land use proposals.
Any injection to facilitate and uphold the rights for First Nations people in WA is a good thing. But it sounds like the announcement's kind of the government giving money to themselves. So, you know, that's a thing I think that needs to be considered. Also, if you look at the balance, at the moment there's a $10 million injection to facilitate the LARCS, the new cultural heritage bill. I think that the 10 mil injection into the LARCs that are going to facilitate cultural heritage responsibility throughout the state, I think it's a bit short, it's a bit skinny. And then you look around and injecting $14 million into that, I just think the balance isn't right. I think that's good that they're putting money into that, so that's a good thing, not dissing it, but I think that there needs to be an injection of more funds to facilitate the rights for the heritage, new Heritage Act as well.
Now, let's shift our focus more towards the future, and hopefully it's a decarbonised future. Australia might be tracking towards a decarbonised economy at a much slower rate than other signatories to the Paris Agreement, but there is still a conversation being had about First Nations people's participation in renewable energy projects. In Canada, Indigenous peoples are at the forefront of the country's clean energy evolution. A Canadian study by Indigenous Clean Energy released in February this year said renewable electricity generating projects with Indigenous participation have skyrocketed in the past two decades. First Nations entities are the beneficiaries of almost 20% of Canada's electricity generating infrastructure, and almost all of that infrastructure is producing renewable energy. In the past 5 years alone, the number of Indigenous clean energy projects has grown by 30% in Canada. This acceleration has largely been catalysed by policy changes and the legal recognition of treaty rights for Indigenous peoples, which is something that Mr. Lowe is advocating for at the highest levels of power. In Canada, these changes have allowed First Nations communities to have authentic co-ownership of projects on ancestral lands and to be able to assert justice and fairness during the project development negotiations. But Mr. Lowe says Australia's First Peoples haven't had the same opportunity, and without serious reform, it's likely the flaws of the mining sector will only repeat themselves in the clean energy sector as well.
Whenever I think of kind of renewable energy projects, we always kind of assume that the degradation won't be as bad. But is that really the case if you're putting, say, like wind turbines, or if you're putting solar panels or
whatever? Well, you still got to use the land.
Yeah.
And these the new guys, the new clean energy guys, and that you think they're the good guys, but they're not used to dealing with blackfellas either. So they're going to go out and destroy heritage sites and all that kind of stuff just the same as mining companies do, et cetera.
Mm.
So there's an education that needs to go in there. So they've still got to use country. And so whether that, like you say, wind turbines, whatnot, I don't know. Back home in Victoria, there's a bunch of wind turbines going up. And basically, you know, they just go up on, you know, pastoral lands and, you know, we don't get to see any benefit from them apart from, you know, the power supply when we turn our lights on or whatever. So there's danger there that similar kind of things happen to what they have happening with the resource industry.
Is there any legislation or is there any kind of frameworks that currently exist to combat that going into the future, or is that kind of uncharted?
Really. It's uncharted. Like, it's just kind of using similar kind of, you know, Heritage Acts and Native Title Act, all those same rules apply. And we know the rules aren't great. So, you know, there isn't at the moment. This conversation's taken place with that First Nations people at the table again. So before too long, and whether that's 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, we're going to be in a new kind of, I guess, this energy transition, and then we'll get to a point where Aboriginal people are being kind of locked out of the game again.
Right.
So you come back to similar to the mining conversation.
Yeah.
And so I think that the government, state governments and federal governments can do better there, there's no doubt. To start thinking about what the role, you know, whether it be using native title lands and what that looks like, and being equity shares and these kind of new energy projects, all that kind of stuff, rather than just kind of, you know, we want to access your land, we'll give you some money, but then, you know, see you later. So I think there needs to be a new way of doing business.
That was National Native Title Council CEO Jamie Lowe speaking to Indie Media's Kelly Warden earlier this week, or last week, sorry. And this is the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. The School of Critical Arts have popped up in the last few years, providing somewhat of an alternative, offering a whole range of courses for people, regardless of their prior learning, and a lot of accessible courses, including free places. To chat about it, I caught up with Carl Glidell from the School of Critical Arts earlier today, just to find out a bit more about the school and some of their upcoming courses. Thanks very much for coming in, Kyle. I guess, you know, the School of Critical Arts, some people might be aware of it, some people are probably not aware of it at all, not even aware of the concept of it. Can I just start by getting you to tell listeners a little bit about the School of Critical Arts? What is it, and, you know, why did it come about?
So it was between a few of us at the number of universities here, a lot of postgraduate students and a few academics who I found it increasingly difficult to talk about the critical arts in university, just lack of funding, cutting of resources, courses, all this sort of stuff. And I mean, we've seen this around the world more generally and in Australia particularly, but we just wanted to start up this school, this small independent school, which looks at the critical arts across a range of different disciplines, from philosophy, the practical arts, visual arts, and critical theory, also sociology, legal theory, and a few other things. Just because, yeah, we don't see a huge focus on these disciplines at the universities anymore. There's a lot of precedence taken over other disciplines, and so we still find it incredibly important to focus upon critical thinking skills, on critical arts, on critique, whether it's of politics, society, and more broadly. So, yeah, we wanted to start up a small school to sort of push these sort of disciplines that aren't so prominent, perhaps, in universities today.
And that's so true, isn't it, that universities very much have changed over the years. I mean, I sort of, you know, look at the uni that I'm at the moment, and it seems to be very much privatized and more about what, you know, what's profitable, and there's a lot of funding in engineering and in business, but less so in critical theory. And, you know, perhaps the history of universities was more a place you go to study for the sake of studying and to gain knowledge and insight and to therefore, you know, contribute to your community through that. Is that something that you found in your own experience, that universities are becoming, I guess, more and more these neoliberal institutions that care less about the, you know, the sort of the I guess, thinking for thinking's sake, and, you know, particularly more radical thinking, and more about just, you know, getting profits in? And is that sort of part of it?
100%, yeah. I think it's this particular ideology that plays out. And, I mean, I've been at university now for maybe 10, 11 years, and even within that span of time, I've seen it sort of ramp up, and it's obviously been going on for a lot longer than that. This kind of neoliberal ideology that creeps up through, where education's seen more as just qualifications for vocational work later on, rather than actual education itself, critical thinking itself, to be, you know, a responsible citizen engaged within a particular society. Yeah, we live in a democracy, so we all need to be educated in order to be able to participate within that democracy to understand what's going on around in the world around us, and universities are meant to be that institution which we gain this kind of education and just become better, or just sort of more, you know, well-rounded people through critical education. But we've seen that less and less through the neoliberalization of the universities, where it's more about money, it's more about bums on seats, it's more about popular courses that give you the supposed skills or the tools to be able to get a job, whether it's in engineering, teaching, management, all of these sort of areas, which are incredibly important. But when you lose the critique side of it and all you have is just sort of the handing out of information in order to be an effective worker contributing to the overall economy of the country, then I think it becomes a bit problematic when the institutions that are there for education become subsumed further into the vocational mindset.
Totally. And I guess another question is the lack of access to university. You know, we now have some universities, you know, reserve a lot of places for full fee-paying students. You know, it's just incredibly expensive. And so I'd imagine for a lot of young people, if they're going to university now, they're really, you know, they might be interested in philosophy or in queer theory or gender studies, but, you know, they've got perhaps family or friend or you know, their parents saying, well, look, you got one shot at going to university, do something that's going to get you a job. And is that part of the School of Critical Arts? Because, you know, you don't have to be, anyone can enroll in the courses. You don't have to be someone that's a, you know, university student. And, you know, I guess it's quite accessible. Is that a huge part of it as well? Is just providing, you know, I guess not necessarily free, but cheaper access to these theories and to these discussions?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. So there's no prior qualifications needed, no prior education needed to take these courses. There will be, you know, some difficult readings. There will be readings that need to be undertaken each week. You will have to engage in the courses in that way. But there's no formal education or anything required. And yeah, we do have free spots available for the classes too. So being a non-for-profit, we do rely heavily on the money coming in for the classes themselves so that we can continue to run them and pay the lecturers and pay the coordinators, the people running the school. But for sure, for those people who can't afford to pay for the classes, for whatever reason, we have free spots available for them.
Awesome. Now, I mean, years ago, I remember seeing I think it was in Spain, there was a couple of sort of squatted universities there and sort of open universities and these projects that took place in them. Perhaps more common in Europe, but there are, you know, open universities in Australia and elsewhere around the world. Mm. Is there any sort of plans for that in the future? I mean, you know, the idea of setting up an entirely alternate university might be a bit grandiose at the moment, but are there plans to sort of expand? I mean, I know you've got a lot of courses coming up this round, whereas last year there was fewer, so obviously it's getting more popular, there's more people getting involved. Yeah. But are there, you know, pipe dreams to try and set up a bit of an alternative open university one day or something like that?
We had discussed this when we first had meetings around the school itself and what we wanted to kind of do with the school. I think if we did move into that sort of territory, it would be a long way off. Yeah. Be huge work trying to get accreditation and all of that sort of thing. For now, it's just a very small school located in Perth. We do have some teachers from Melbourne, I think, this year. Or actually, we did. And we may have some more coming up. But but for the most part, it's just a local sort of Perth-only school. Just very small classes, 9, 10, 11 students in each class. Just sort of to bring it back to the sort of face-to-face learning. That was the other thing we really wanted to focus on with this school too, I think. Not so much pitted as, like, I know we've talked about the neoliberalization of the university and that kind of thing. Not to pit it so much as like an alternative to the university, but something that we feel is lacking or missing in the university. There's still a lot of good that goes in the universities. There's a lot of good teachers there that still do promote this kind of critical education. But so we sort of want to work together with that sort of aspect of the university to sort of offer some things that the universities, or particularly teachers within the universities, can't offer now for various reasons, for workloads, underpay, or all of these kind of things. We sort of wanted to offer that experience for students who had come up through university, perhaps done a few units, in philosophy or political science or sociology or the arts, and sort of wanted to do some more of that, and can't really do it in the means within the university at the moment. Like, there just isn't any more on offer because there's a strain on resources and teachers and that. So yeah, we wanted to sort of offer what universities more traditionally had done.
And just create that space to have those discussions. And I imagine in a class of 10 people, there's a lot more opportunity to talk and discuss. Whereas, you know, if you're in a class of 30 people, I guess in my experience of being in classes and so forth, you can get a little bit lost, or trying to fit, 30 people into 3 hours and get everyone to express themselves is pretty difficult.
There's time constraints. It's hard. There's only so much the teachers can do in that sort of environment. So, yeah, we really wanted to focus on the community and dialogue first and foremost. That was critical discussion of ideas through a small group of people so that you can get a lot more done in an hour or two.
Awesome. So you've got a whole bunch of courses coming up starting around June, going all the way through to December. You don't have to talk about all the courses coming up, but are there a few things that stand out for you? And how do people, if they're interested in this, how do they register? How do they get involved? And, what's sort of plan for this year, basically?
So we've got quite a few courses still to come up this year. I think 10 or 11 courses running every month. But 10 or 11 in total, with at least one course running every month. We've got three classes coming up next month, I believe, beginning at the start of June. One on legal theory and Indigenous legal narratives within legal theory. One on critical reading, which is just looking at critical reading skills, critical argumentation, particularly with the uptake of science and sort of politics today and through social media and all the rest of it. And one on reimagining democracy, which you yourself, I understand, have got a hand in.
I'm doing a lecture on that. I should give a full disclosure that I am, at least participating somewhat in it. So,
and we have a few more courses. For all the information, it's available online at criticalarts.org.au, or if you just Google School of Critical Arts, the website will come up. We have Instagram and Facebook pages as well, but you can go through the website, and that's where you can enroll for the courses. All the information will be on there. The classes running out of the new Fremantle Library, and the practical arts classes running out of
a space in Burswood, Carl was going to say there. That's Carl Gladal, who's from the School of Critical Arts. You can find out more about them at criticalarts.org.au. Just to reiterate, in full disclosure, I am doing one lecture as a part of that course. So, it's a little bit of a disclosure there. Quickly, a couple of news items concerning the ongoing occupation of Palestine. Israeli officials have approved more than 4,000 new homes in illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In response, the Israeli group Peace Now tweeted, "The state of Israel took another stumble toward the abyss and further deepened the occupation. It's bad news for Israel and for anyone who cares about the people in our region." And in related news, Israeli forces fired stun grenades and assaulted mourners carrying the casket of slain Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abdul Alkeh in Jerusalem yesterday. Israeli authorities ambushed Palestinian mourners before they could even leave the premises of a hospital for a procession to Abdul Alkeh's funeral service. They were forced to place the casket inside a car to be transported to a church for the services. This comes only days after Abdul Alkeh was shot in the head while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. On Thursday, the Al Jazeera network published a new video evidence that Palestinian fighters were not in the vicinity of Shireen Abdul Alkeh when she was killed, and that the Israeli troops had a clear line of fire on her position. That's all we have time for today on the Indie Media Show. If you enjoyed the program, you can always restream it at rtrfm.com.au. You can listen to a whole bunch of our interviews via our SoundCloud, and this program is also available as a podcast. If you like the show, if you like what we do, you can always get in touch either via the corporate social media. We've got a Facebook page if that's your thing. Otherwise, you can always get in touch via RTR. We're always keen to hear your ideas for stories or any other input or feedback. Keep it locked, though. It's coming up very shortly. Rhiann Todd-Hunter is going to take you out to lunch. That's all your new music needs for your Monday afternoon to get you ready for the week ahead. And we'll be back next week, though, at 11 a.m. for more indie media news.